You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 30th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, will Hamas accept a ceasefire deal from Israel? The US Secretary of State suggests they should. We'll examine the possibility of a temporary peace. Also ahead on today's programme, Greece says it needs an Iron Dome anti-missile defence system. We'll ask why. Plus,
there are about 7 million Sudanese who are internally displaced, and so to have Ukraine saying this support was like a lifeline, and the deliveries that had been made in February already contributed to improving the feeding conditions of well over 400,000 Sudanese.
We'll find out why Ukraine, a country in the teeth of conflict with Russia, can still reach out to help nations in need of food by sending grain. Our paper review will come from Kenya and
the concert, which is set to break attendance records, has caused a citywide mobilization, not seen since Rio hosted the Olympics in 2016.
Madonna ends her tour with a huge free concert in Brazil. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. We start today with the latest on a potential ceasefire between Israel and Hamas as a delegation is in Egypt for talks. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has said he is hopeful that Hamas will accept what he describes as an extraordinarily generous Gaza ceasefire offer from Israel. It's thought to include a 40-day truce in the territory in return for the staged release of Israeli hostages. Well, I'm joined now by Nimrod Goren, Senior Fellow for Israeli Affairs at the Middle East Institute, and the founder of the Israeli foreign policy think tank, Mitvim, and the journalist Ruth Michelson. They both join me on the line from Jerusalem this morning. A very good morning to you both.
Good morning. Nimrod,
just bring us up to date, if you wouldn't mind, please, on what the latest state of play is on this deal.
We are in a crucial date at the moment. After several months of attempts to reach temporary pause in fighting in Gaza in return for some Israeli hostages held by Hamas, it seems like things are converging. And after talks held by Secretary Blinken in the region, now the board is in Hamas' hands, waiting to give a reply to an offer developed by Egypt in coordination with the Israelis and with others for a deal, like you mentioned, that basically could bring home 33 or so out of the more than 100 Israeli hostages held in Hamas in return for a six-week pause. Another element that will change realities in Gaza, but also open doors to diplomatic efforts to diffuse tensions elsewhere in the region.
So, Ruth, let's just go through this, the offer on the table in a little bit more detail. We have the return of displaced Palestinians to their homes in Gaza, the withdrawal of some Israeli military units from the territory. But we have this exchange on the table, don't we? Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners that could be released from Israeli jails in return for what? Just 33 Israeli hostages?
That's right. So there would be, the idea is that very similar to the discussions that happened over the previous months, that there is an initial phase where there would be 33 hostages who are women, elderly, sick people, people who are injured, people that Hamas considers civilians, who would be exchanged for a large number of Palestinian prisoners. I think we should also be clear about the terms of what could happen after that, which has proved a significant stumbling block, which is about discussions of the length of this pause in fighting and when there is a discussion of a permanent end to the fighting. And also the sticking point that has been about the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. So the latest Israeli offer, according to some reporting in Axios, was about the withdrawal of Israeli troops from a corridor that divides the northern part of Gaza from the southern part of Gaza. But what Hamas have said for months is that they will only accept a full Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza. And this is all happening as the Israeli military have said that they are preparing plans to attack Rafah in the south, if this deal falls through, and that this is the context in which this discussion is happening.
Nimrod, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who's been in the region trying to sort of shape this and move this along, has said that this offer from the Israelis is extraordinarily generous. Would you agree?
I think the criticism in Israel is about the generosity that Netanyahu introduces at this moment, and why wasn't it in place 3 months ago? Because as was mentioned, this deal was debated already before Ramadan, and wasn't delivered. And in Israel, there's a lot of criticism about whether the prime minister gave enough leeway to his negotiators to actually come up with those proposals that then he opposed and now he accepts. There are still uncertainties about whether he will be able to pass this deal within his coalition that includes far-right members that do not want the conditions of that deal. So while the current Israeli offer is definitely a better one than the previous ones, it's still not clear that even if Hamas answers positively, what it will mean domestically in Israeli politics, and it will mean some challenges for coalition stability, and whether Netanyahu could and wants to push it through is not for sure yet.
Ruth, what do you believe has changed since the last offer and this latest one?
I mean, we've certainly seen plenty of shifts in terms of this international pressure and negotiations to try and spur this on. I mean, I think the main shift is that, you know, this talk of a Rafah invasion, I think, is changing things. That there's some reporting this morning in the Israeli media that the IDF approved plans to invade Rafah on Monday, and they said that, you know, this would be possible if there's no deal. And I think that some of the context in which these discussions are happening has changed, but the fundamentals of the discussion of what's on the table and how both parties feel about it, we've seen for some time, for months, that there have been these are two groups of people that are very far apart in terms of coming to an agreement on some key issues. Central to this, of course, is, again, it's whether there are Israeli troops still in Gaza. It's about the length of a potential ceasefire. And we've seen in the past that there's been this kind of agreement around the edges about a willingness to discuss certain issues and say, yes, we're willing to have a discussion, but that ultimately ends up falling apart. And that's why we've seen more recently that the Qatari mediators have said that they have, you know, that they're considering withdrawing from their role as the mediator, and they're reconsidering this because there are some real fundamental differences. And so I think there is a lot of goodwill in this moment to try and make something happen. There certainly seems to be a lot of positive noises about the idea from both parties about a willingness to have a discussion and get to a deal. But whether that actually overcomes some of these fundamental disagreements that have plagued this until now, that does seem very unclear.
Because this is a big problem, isn't it, Nimrod, that the Israelis have said, or Benjamin Netanyahu has said, that ultimately Hamas needs to be removed from Gaza.
Yes, the Israeli war objectives speak about dismantling the Hamas military capabilities and making sure that Hamas will not continue to govern the Gaza Strip. That's the Israeli military rationale for looking into an operation of some sort in Rafah that will be coordinated with the Americans and the Egyptians within the red lines or request they pose in order to go after the remaining units of Hamas over there. This is debated, but that is the rationale, making sure there is no continuation of Hamas posing a military threat to Israel. Now, the problem with Hamas being weakened is that Netanyahu is reluctant from going after the modality of a new leadership that will enter Gaza from the Palestinian side, from the Palestinian Authority side. And that means that there is no clarity about what is the day after goal for Israel, apart from keeping some troops over there and hoping for some international body that will come and take over the civilian affairs. So this lack of clarity on the day after and these gaps between what is needed in order to achieve the goal of not having Hamas actually rule Gaza and what Netanyahu is willing to do, this gap is an issue of a contention between Israel and its Western allies, but also an issue of domestic debate within the Israeli political space.
Tell us a little bit more, therefore, about how the Israelis solve this domestically, because we have seen so many schisms appearing within Israel's government that one wonders which direction Israel, well, which path Israel will ultimately take.
I mean, I think that this is a moment at a bit of a crossroads for Benjamin Netanyahu in particular. There's pressure from Benny Gantz saying that he needs to do the deal, but that the deal shouldn't this deal shouldn't include any agreements around a permanent end to the fighting. There are much more extreme right finance minister in Israel told Netanyahu that his government would potentially have no right to exist if it agrees to the deal that's currently on the table. And then you also have the families of and supporters of these families of the hostages that are held inside Gaza, who have worked unbelievably hard since October to keep the plight of their loved ones at the forefront of the national conversation. And that we've seen things earlier this week, like they're increasingly showing up outside Benjamin Netanyahu's private homes in Jerusalem, one on the coast, and, holding these rather intense protests, in some cases setting fire to things, really trying to make the point that they need to be listened to and that the hostages need to be the first priority, and that Netanyahu should put aside these kinds of political concerns about saving his own career, because, of course, there's all of this consideration that any pause in fighting means that there would potentially be some examination of his leadership. And that, the families of these hostages are trying to force the point that there are, this government is supposed to be taking care of its people, and that we have seen that the journey to this point has really thrown that into question. And so there are a lot of angry people from different, all across the political spectrum in Israel that, want very different things out of the current situation.
Finally, staying with you and briefly, the role of the United States here. We've talked about Antony Blinken. We've got Mahmoud Abbas pleading with the US, saying it is the only voice that can stop Israel from attacking Rafah. And then we've got news breaking overnight is that the US is now opposing the ICC's investigation into alleged war crimes in Gaza. By all accounts, the court was poised to issue an arrest warrant against the likes of Benjamin Netanyahu. And the US has stepped in and says, no, you can't do it. There's still a palpable sense that the US does have a little bit of influence here, despite what we've seen in the last few months. That's to Ruth.
Oh, thank you. Yes, the US absolutely does have influence over the situation. I mean, there's, Abbas said this himself in Riyadh yesterday, that, the US has to be the one to step in. And there's certainly this idea that the US is the only party that could potentially constrain any Rafah operation, and that, as you mentioned, that they are now becoming a major player in the discussions around the ICC. So immense pressure on Joe Biden moving forward. But, I mean, there's an argument that has been made all the way along that as much as Biden talks about, a need to make sure that civilians are taken care of in Rafah before any attack or anything like this, that if the US continues to sell weapons to Israel, as it has done, that really rather undermines some of these points. And so, there is an argument that there's, certainly accusations of contradictory US policy in some ways.
Ruth Michelson and Nimrod Gorin in Jerusalem, thank you both so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. AM in Athens, 7:14 AM here in London. Now, many will be familiar with Israel's famous so-called Iron Dome, the country's missile defence system developed with the US and aimed at protecting the country against attacks from the air. Its most recent deployment was during Iran's missile attack on Israel a couple of weeks ago. Well, Israel is a country in conflict and with no shortage of adversaries in the region. So why is Greece, a reasonably peaceable nation in the grand scheme of things, saying it needs one too? Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Monocle's newsletters editor, Emmanuel Papavassiliou. A very good morning to you, Emmanuel.
Hi, good morning.
So what are they asking for?
So basically, we have to understand that Greece, contrary to other European countries, is kind of surrounded by what it perceives as threats. So you have, for example, North Macedonia, Bulgaria in the north, and most notably Turkey in the east. So we have to remember that in 2022, in October, there was a significant stalemate between Greece and Turkey in the Aegean. Since then, they have quashed the beef, if you want to put it that way. Greek Prime Minister Mitsotakis and has done significant efforts to become friendlier with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They signed a friendly, a friendship agreement in December. But the problem since then is that both of them have significantly boosted their defense systems. So Greece, Turkey from its side, has completely reiterated its a doctrine, a rhetoric that they keep repeating called the Blue Homeland. And that is the idea that parts of the Aegean belong to them. So much so that we're looking at Turkish schools from the next year, including it into their textbooks. And with the idea that parts of the Aegean belong to them, the significance of the invasion of Cyprus, and so on and so. But Greece, from its part, looks at this, looks at the beef up of Turkish military boosts in their drones and their naval systems. And it's in a bit of a pickle because from one hand, they want to be friendly. From the other, they want to be ready for all eventualities.
It's an interesting point that you raise there, given the fact that, you know, NATO membership, EU membership, all these things which actually should protect Greece and, you know, Turkey also inside NATO as well. Why on earth would there be this feeling that Greece needs to have such a high level of anti-MSL protection?
It mainly stems because of the history between the two. And it's a back and forth relationship. Despite the fact that they're both in NATO, they both need to show significant muscle and the fact that one can protect itself. But the problem with Greece is that, contrary to Turkey, is that it doesn't actually create its own weapons. It doesn't have a weapons industry. And as a result, they need to completely reform their army, which hasn't been reformed since the 70s. And that's why Greece is now undertaking this big reform program called Agenda 2030. And it's trying to find ways to boost its three main forces, so the sea, the air, and the ground, but at the same time create new divisions such as a cybersecurity division, a data crunching division, and as we mentioned, this new idea of an Iron Dome, which Nikos Dentias, the defense minister, has recently talked about. And that is mainly to be able to defend against a potential attack, let's say, by Turkey's very powerful Turkish-made drones. It could never happen, but the idea is just to have it there in terms of showing, you know, we are capable, we have the muscle, and we are equal partners in talks.
It's quite an expensive deterrent, and historically Greece has had to pull itself up from a really, really difficult financial period in the last decade. It's recovered. It's doing very, very well. But where is the money for this?
Well, the money for this exists now because Greece is in a bit of a new financial position after years of austerity. And they're trying to see in which better way they can, you know, boost themselves in all sectors. But it hasn't been paid yet. It's been earmarked. It's 2 billion that we're talking about that has been earmarked. We don't know yet how they will buy it, who will they buy it from, and who will help them build it. But it's, for the moment, it's just a statement that, look, this is our plan, this is our plan, and this is what we want to do. And weirdly enough, there hasn't been any political pushback from other parties.
It is a big question. I mean, how have the German German, the Greek politicians reacted to this? And indeed, how have Greek people reacted to this?
I think it's been very positive. From politicians, there hasn't been any pushback, as I've said. There haven't been any significant... comments against it. That is because they all, at the moment, because of the Euro elections, they're all trying to appease the public, and the public really loves the idea of being able to defend against Turkey, because the fact that we need to be powerful against Turkey is a common universal feeling amongst all Greek citizens.
Emmanuel Papavasiliou, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Still to come on today's programme.
When you have a situation where there's an immediate relief, it sends a very strong message to citizens that the government and the rest of the world care about their current conditions. They're looking for ways to help. And it also reinforces that bond between citizens, society and the state.
We find out how Ukraine is still, despite being at war with Russia, able to send food aid abroad. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Here in London. Let's continue with today's newspapers. Joining me is Navina Kotto, Monocle's Nairobi correspondent. Good morning, Navina.
Good morning, Emma.
Now, ordinarily, we ask you how the weather is, but there has been a significant tragedy happening in Kenya with the deaths of 45 people dying after a flood.
Yes, the weather has changed significantly over the last couple of weeks. We've seen very heavy rain that has affected the capital, Nairobi, destroyed infrastructure to an extent that I think is unprecedented. Bridges have been swept away. I've seen walls collapse because the ground can't hold the moisture or the water anymore. And as you say, there have been a lot of casualties, not just in Nairobi, but also outside Nairobi, where people were overwhelmed by flash floods and swept away in them. And we have been told to brace ourselves for more rains in the coming week and possibly in May, with announcements expected later today.
Now, one thing that you wanted to draw our attention to was the country's ability to deal with major weather events.
Yes, exactly. It is something that the president has talked about a lot. He has so far not really addressed the nation and said how he's planning to respond to this tragedy. But there are people saying that Kenya is facing worsening flood crisis due to the combined effects of El Nino and climate change. One of them was the Secretary General of the International Federation of the Red Cross, who was clearly referring to climate patterns that have been affected and got worse over the last decade. And there are people, not just in Kenya, saying that the country needs to be able to build some kind of resilience to adapt to these kind of climate threats, saying that these extremes that we've been seeing since I've lived here, there was a very severe drought that affected farmers and food production. And now we're seeing this very heavy rain that's also going to affect food production and the infrastructure, and that the country needs to find ways to adapt to it. And this is a discussion that comes up over and over again. I think we've heard it again at COP last year, that richer countries who are contributing to this climate crisis need to support these countries financially.
Let's move on to regional elections in Togo. Tell us, bring us up to date with that and how the press are covering that.
Yes, Togo went to vote. Togolese were invited to vote yesterday. From what we understand, the vote got underway very calm. There have been no protests. In the run-up to this election, there was a lot of controversy around constitutional changes that have been brought in by the sitting president, Faure Gnassi Igbe. He's basically changed the constitution in a way that Togo will shift from a presidential to a parliamentary system, meaning that he will not be elected anymore, which kind of sounds positive, considering he's been in power for 20 years. But it basically means that he has engineered a system that will allow him to stay in power. And because he's the leader of the majority party, he's expected to win also this parliamentary election. And so there has been a lot of criticism around this. So we're expecting the announcement to be made today or tomorrow. And we're expecting him to stay in power.
Let's move on. We're going to move all over the place with today's newspaper review. Let's look to an article in the Africa Report, which is cataloguing an absolute unravelling of relations between Washington and the United States and Niger. And as Niger ordered American troops out of the country a few weeks ago, and things are not going well as the exit strategy is being managed.
Yes, exactly. It is an issue. The relationship between the Sahel and Niger and the West, it is something that we have discussed in the past. We also covered this on The Globalist before, that early April, a Russian plane arrived in Niger to basically carrying Russian military trainers and equipment. I think it's the beginning of a probably very close relationship between Russia and Niger, but it also marks the end of a very close relationship between the West, the United States, Europe, France, the UK and Niger. As you say, the United States have been ordered to withdraw their troops, around 1,000 from the country. That's kind of going to bring an end to the largest US military presence in a region that is regarded as a hotbed of global jihadism and Islamist violence. It is a request by the country's junta, and it is something that the US government was trying to avoid desperately. I think it was one of the reasons why the US administration delayed calling what happened in Niger last year a coup, but it looks like this US strategy has failed.
And we move now to Burkina Faso, where there has been a significant decrease in news access, with basically the big names when it comes to international media being kicked out. Bring us the latest on that.
Exactly. It all goes back to a Human Rights Watch report that was published in February, and the detail that the military allegedly executed at least 223 civilians as part of a counterterrorism operation. This was covered by several media outlets, including by Le Monde, The Guardian, Deutsche Welle, TV5 Du Monde and Voice of America, and all of these organizations have now been suspended for they will not be allowed to broadcast, but I'm assuming it will also be very difficult to enter the country. I have to say there is a bit of a history now. Again, Burkina Faso is a military-led government of international media houses being expelled. In the past, France 24, Radio France International and Jeune Afrique were expelled, as well as two journalists who were traveling there independently. And I had a look at the media in Burkina Faso this morning, and it's probably not a surprise that neither the radio television of Burkina Faso is covering it. You can't find it in the Burkinabe newspaper. So I think it gives you a sense of the propaganda that surrounding this military government.
And it's one of those difficult situations, because there is then that even more intense need to report what is going on. But when you do not have the main news outlets there, then you look to local media, and then that throws up all manner of challenges and security risks.
Exactly. It presents a very skewed idea of what is happening in the country. If you look at it now, they're talking about the inauguration of an industrial complex. Obviously, there's a picture of the military leader on the front page. It talks about industrial development, the creation of jobs. All of these are things that are key to the propaganda of the military government. But it doesn't really tell you anything about the fact that the security situation in Burkina, despite the military coup, has deteriorated. It also doesn't tell you anything about a crackdown on civil society or media organizations. So I think it's very tricky for people on the ground to access the information that they need, or from outside to assess what's actually happening there.
Navina Kotto, thank you as ever for joining us on the line to bring us the newspaper review. The time here in London is just nudging 7:29 a.m. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Let's have a look at some of the other headlines making today's news. Columbia University has begun to suspend student activists who refuse to dismantle a pro-Palestinian protest camp. The university president said that days of negotiations between student organizers and academic leaders have failed to persuade demonstrators to remove the dozens of tents set up to express opposition to Israel's war in Gaza. UN monitors say a missile that landed in Kharkiv in Ukraine bore the markers of being from North Korea. The inspectors said the debris was from a missile that was in violation of the arms embargo on North Korea. Meanwhile, Russia says it's taken another village in the course of its offensive in eastern Ukraine. It's the second in 2 days. President Zelensky said Moscow was taking advantage of delays in the West, sending more weapons. The Philippines have accused China's Coast Guard of harassment and damaging one of its boats in a disputed area of the South China Sea. The Philippine Coast Guard said its two vessels stood their ground at the Scarborough Shoal but were damaged by a water cannon fired at them by the Chinese. Beijing has denied the claims. And the French actor Gérard Depardieu is in custody over allegations of sexual assault. Media reports from Paris suggest the 75-year-old was summoned for questioning yesterday morning. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine has had an impact far beyond Kyiv's borders. As one of the world's largest suppliers of corn and wheat, there have been fears ever since the start of the war that the conflict could trigger a global food crisis. But despite the limitations posed by conflict, Ukraine has continued with its global relief program, Grain from Ukraine. It was launched by President Volodymyr Zelensky late in 2022 as part of the Black Sea Initiative. Well, earlier Monocle's senior foreign correspondent Carlotta Rabello heard from Dr. Chris Formogno, who's a goodwill ambassador to the Grain from Ukraine initiative and the regional director of Central and West Africa programs at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. Carlotta began by asking Dr. Chris about the latest shipment of more than 14,000 tons of grain from Ukraine, which arrived recently in Sudan.
Let's start perhaps with a look at the announcement that was made last week. We're talking here about 14,000 tons of Ukrainian grain that has arrived in Sudan. Tell us more about this.
In fact, I should say that this was the second delivery of grain from Ukraine to the people of Sudan. Last week's delivery was 14,000 delivered in Port Sudan. And 2 months earlier, in February 2024, a first delivery had happened to people in Khartoum. As we all know, Sudan is facing a civil war, really, today. It's an armed conflict that has generated the highest population of displaced persons globally. There are about 7 million Sudanese who are internally displaced, and there are about a million others who are now refugees in neighboring African countries. And so to have Ukraine send this support was like a lifeline. And just this morning, I understand from the World Food Program that the deliveries that had been made in February had already contributed to improving the feeding conditions of well over 400,000 Sudanese. That's very heartwarming.
Well, you mentioned there the humanitarian crisis that is being felt in Sudan, and indeed it is quite severe. We're talking here about almost 18 million people facing acute food insecurity and millions more of children, 3.8 million Sudanese children under 5 years old who are reported to be malnourished. So this is really vital to have a program like this to provide this sort of relief.
It is vital indeed. And also, you know, it reinforces the fact that Ukraine, which used to be one of the breadbaskets of the world, it's going to great lengths to make sure that it can maintain its humanitarian commitments, despite itself facing a state of aggression from Russia, aggression and war from Russia. And so there's multiple stories in here. First, the human dimension of just being able to provide relief. Millions of people are at the risk of famine or starvation, including lots of children and women. And then there's also just that other aspect of saying, even when a country is in need, it still is looking out for the most vulnerable in other parts of the world.
Well, you mentioned there the role that Ukraine has played prior to the war in supplying the world with food. More than 15% of global corn exports, 10% of wheat, but up to 20% of barley was coming from Ukraine. So the war has really disrupted where these supplies were going. Is there a sense in the countries and in the regions that the Grain from Ukraine initiative is unfolding and taking place? Is there a sense here of the great lengths, as you were describing, that the country is going to try to maintain its aid and humanitarian program?
Yes, there is. As you can imagine, the list of countries that would like to benefit from this initiative continues to grow. But at the same time, there's real concerns that the war on Ukraine is also ongoing, that even the infrastructure in ports such as Odessa that in the past that allowed for an easy transportation of this grain towards needing countries, that some of that infrastructure has been destroyed, that farmlands, parts of Ukraine that used to be farmlands are now have been mined and have been abandoned. And so I would say about a quarter of Ukraine's farming agrarian capacity is being impacted. We've even had stories of over 300,000 tons of grain that was already stocked in Odessa and in other places were bombed by Russia. And so that level of anxiety, not just in these vulnerable countries, but even globally, because even in the countries that are not facing famine, there's been a noticeable increase in food prices. And so there's a level of alarm that's out there, a level of anxiety that if this war is not brought to an end, there's going to be so much destruction on Ukraine's capacity to produce and to export grain to the world that vulnerable populations that are facing famine and starvation would suffer. But even countries that are not facing those conditions will see a tremendous increase and inflation in food prices.
I know that on top of this work, you've, you know, worked with international election observation missions and helped with democracy support programs in the region and in many countries across the African continent. This sort of initiative to solve such a crucial and vital issue, or to help solve, of course, it's not a solution in itself, but to help solve famine and inadequate food supplies, it is much needed to allow these countries that have been ravaged by, at times, internal conflict to make democratic transitions. Now, I'm quite curious about the role that this humanitarian mission can also help, can also play in aiding the democratic process across the continent.
That's an excellent question, because issues of food security are really transversal in terms of their impact. Because when people don't have access to food and they can't feed themselves, communities get dislocated. Then you have internally displaced persons. In the case of northern Kenya, we had people moving their cattle and moving villages and, you know, losing their cattle in that process. There's a certain level of instability that is generated by the inability of citizens to feed themselves. And that also pushes them to then be more disaffected in terms of wondering why their governments cannot respond to their immediate needs, why democracy is not delivering. But when you have a situation where there's an immediate relief, it sends a very strong message to citizens that the government and the rest of the world care about their current conditions. They're listening, they're looking for ways to help. And it also, secondly, reinforces that bond between citizens, society, and the state, which then allows other institutions to function. We also know that when countries are facing food insecurity and have to find ways to address that, there's always a shifting of resources that would otherwise go into other social services such as healthcare, education, infrastructure development, to be able to import and sometimes subsidize these foods, as tends to happen in most developing countries. But when you have a country like Ukraine stepping forward with a stopgap measure, even if it's just a stopgap measure to feed the most needy for the moment, it gives a lot of these fragile democracies a breather. And I think that's one element that also needs to be emphasized in this process.
That was Dr. Chris Fumunyo, who's Goodwill Ambassador to the Grain from Ukraine initiative, talking to Monocle's Carlotta Ribello. You're listening to Monocle Radio. :38 in Berlin, which is where we head now, because nine people have gone on trial in the southern German city of Stuttgart in one of three cases linked to an alleged far-right plot to overthrow the state. The charges they face include high treason, attempted murder, and membership of a terrorist organisation. The nine have been identified as a so-called Reichsbürger, belonging to the military wing of a group led by a self-styled aristocrat. Well, Suda David-Wilp is director of the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office. I'm delighted to say she joins us on the line now. Suda, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Emma.
If you could just recap this plot, which sort of defies description, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems almost farcical, but it really is signaled a potential threat here in Germany. In December of 2022, the police raided a number of homes and institutions all across Germany, where they rounded up various people coming from different points of walks of life that had weapons and plans to overthrow the German government. This group, the so-called Reichsbürger, they're numbering around 23,000 all around Germany, do not believe in the modern German state and would like to return Germany to its 1871 borders.
So this is what they want. This is what the Reichsbürger stand for. But what kind of major threat were they posing to German society, given the fact that they're facing some pretty hefty charges?
Well, the fact that, I mean, I think it's very easy to just dismiss this group as some quack organization. But you have to remember that also in 2020, during the pandemic, Reichsbürger were also seen trying to storm the parliament. So there have been hints of extremism from this group, and the fact that they have this these cachet of weapons and plans to overthrow the government. And political violence is not unheard of in Germany. In 2019, a local politician named Walter Lübcke from the CDU, the Conservatives, was killed in front of his home by a right extremist.
So to what degree, I mean, given that what you've just said, to what degree do the likes of the Reichsbürger mirror any element of German society and any major threat it may pose?
Well, I think it all boils down to diminishing trust here in Germany on the part of the electorate with regard to the chancellor and institutions. I mean, there's still a high regard for groups like the police and perhaps the constitutional court, but like other liberal democracies in the United States and all across Europe, people seem disenchanted with their political elected officials. And this is how also the AfD, a group on the right, the far right, has also gained a lot of traction over the years in Germany. They're polling at about 20% and have caused a lot of political fragmentation in the political landscape here.
As a result, when we look at this is what the first of three trials that the Reichsbürger are appearing in. When you talk about the context of a general disenchantment, we see the rise of the likes of the AfD and the far right, to publicise a trial and to have these processes going through Germany for a long, long time. What effect do you think that might have? Because there are some concerns that actually to give oxygen to this would actually make the problem worse.
Well, I think it is also a matter of, I mean, one could perhaps argue that, but on the flip side, I think it's also an opportunity for German decision makers and stakeholders to show that there are a lot of people in Germany that are affected by disinformation. You know, voters are going to have the chance to make decisions with regard to the EU at the beginning of June, and then there are three crucial state elections in the East. And it's not just disinformation from, you know, groups like QAnon within Germany, but also authoritarian actors like Russia and China that use this mistrust, this disenchantment to try to destabilize democracy.
Thank you so much for joining us on the line. That was Suda David-Wilp from the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 7:44 here in London. It's time now to talk aviation with Murdo Morrison, Head of Strategic Content at Flight Global, who joins us once again. A very good morning to you, Murdo.
Good morning, Emma.
Let's talk about Dubai Airport. Not big enough.
Yes, Dubai Airport is the biggest or the busiest international airport in the world, but they are going to move it, or at least build an even bigger airport out in the desert called Al Maktoum International. Now, this airport has been in existence since, I think, 2010 it officially opened, but until now it's really been used for cargo flights and a very limited number of passenger flights. Because it's in the desert, south of the city of Dubai, there is plenty room to expand. It's essentially out in the desert. So the vision for this that was, we've been expecting it for many, many years, but it was confirmed by Dubai's ruler this week that it's now going to go ahead. It's going to be there's going to be five runways, four separate terminal buildings or concourses, 400 gates. And it's going to be have a capacity of 260 million passengers. And just to put that into context, that's about 2.5 times the number of passengers that that Dubai International currently handles.
It's enough to make your head spin and make you very, very late for your gate. One wonders how far you have to walk to get from terminal to terminal. But let's talk a little bit more about the regional context here, because we have Doha, which has an enormous airport. And we also now have Saudi Arabia, which is starting up Riyadh Air. It's building airports left, right and centre. It wants to have a slice of the pie as well. How big a regional hub are we now looking at in the Middle East?
Yes, I mean it's quite incredible actually, because Abu Dhabi as well has also just.
Oh, I'd forgotten about Abu Dhabi. Sorry about that, Murdo.
Brand new mega terminal there as well. So yes, I mean there is competition obviously between the three big Gulf hubs. Don't forget Turkish Airlines as well, not that far away in Istanbul, is also offering that sort of same global east to west connectivity model. So yes, there's. Aviation is expanding, global travel is expanding, and obviously Dubai, like everyone else, expects that to grow exponentially over the next few decades. It's just whether there will be capacity for enough traffic for all these airports.
Indeed, I mean, they're all eating each other's lunch. Who's going to win here?
Well, I think Dubai was the first mover in this. Dubai did. Dubai's been doing this for 30 years, really, for this model of global connectivity. And their existing airport, Dubai International, it's fairly constrained in terms of its physical footprint. So there are roads and buildings all around it. And it's pretty much at the limit now of where it can be in terms of expansion. So they do need to build this new airport. Like a lot of things in Dubai, we'll have to wait and see whether it will actually be open in 10 years, as they're saying. Things do tend to get delayed a little bit, but certainly eventually the plan is to move everything to this mega new airport.
I'd hate to be called to gate 460. Right, let's talk about IndiGo. It is IndiGo, the airline, which is now part of a bigger transformation of the Indian aviation market.
Yeah, I mean, we've just talked about the Middle East there, but India also has huge ambitions to be, have a piece of this cake as well and be part of this whole global connectivity market. There's obviously a huge domestic market in India that's not really been properly exploited. The infrastructure isn't very good. The airlines until recently weren't very good either. But now you have Air India, so revitalized Air India, and now Indigo, their main competitor, you know, with huge fleet expansion plans. Indigo's just announced orders for 30 A350s. That's the, you know, the biggest Airbus wide body now that the A380 hasn't been made, and 70 options as well. So they have huge ambitions. They were just a single aisle operator currently. So they have huge ambitions to be a global carrier connecting India to the world. Their rival Air India as well, as I said, also, you know, massively expanding fleet, new aircraft. So both these airlines and a lot of other startups as well, really transforming India's aviation landscape. And it really looks like India is going to be the next, you know, huge emerging market for aviation.
Murdo, very briefly, we've only got about 30 seconds to look at this, but when you look at the fact that we've just talked about the Middle East becoming an enormous aviation powerhouse, let me talk about India being an enormous aviation powerhouse. How is aviation going to be reconfigured in this way?
Well, it's interesting to see. I think, you know, if we look at historical traffic expansion, demand for flying, that is continuing to grow exponentially. And it just gives people, you know, traditionally, people at the moment from India to do a lot of long haul flights, you have to connect somewhere else to the Middle East. This gives people in India now a chance to connect to the world directly.
Murdo Morrison, thank you so much for joining us on the line. You're with The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Now, the Financial Times has struck a deal with the owner of ChatGPT, OpenAI, to allow its content to be used in the training of its intelligence systems. This means that ChatGPT users will, at one point, receive summaries and quotes from FT journalism, as well as links to articles. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Josh Coles, consultant and writer about technology policy and a regular voice on Monocle Radio. Welcome back, Josh.
Good to be here.
Explain how this is going to work, please.
Well, it's interesting, as you said in your intro there, that this will involve not only snippets of FT journalism, but also links back to the Financial Times. And I think that's probably quite interesting in the context of this deal, because one of the major concerns that news publishers have about the rise of ChatGPT and other generative AI tools is simply that they'll lose traffic, they'll lose revenue to their own pages where they can monetize for advertising, and ChatGPT will enjoy all the benefits of that instead. So the fact that they're engaging with OpenAI to actually get some links back to the FT is, I think, quite interesting, although it does open the possibility that the FT's quite strong paywall could be found ways around here through the use of OpenAI instead. So I think it's paints quite an interesting picture, really, about the future of these kinds of ChatGPT style tools, and also the news companies and the other information organizations, publishers, which are involved in actually providing, willingly or not, the training data that makes them work.
The big question that's asked here and needs explaining is to what degree, not whether the Financial Times and its journalism will influence ChatGPT, but whether ChatGPT could influence the Financial Times' writing and journalism.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, for a long time, news organizations have adapted their content, let's say, for search engines in a process known as search engine optimization. So newsrooms around the world will be very familiar with what it takes to have their news reports show up in search results like Google. Of course, this is slightly different and probably a bit more nuanced, in that users of ChatGPT have a bit more ability to express exactly what it is they want to find out about some given news story or other sources of information compared with, say, a Google search. The caveat, though, is that typically these models aren't up to date with the absolute latest information. They typically have a cutoff of months or years prior, which means that traditional news organizations for sort of up-to-date stories will still have the upper hand, at least for the moment, in that. But I suspect that gap will start to close as time moves on.
Now, this isn't the first deal of its kind, isn't it? Is it? Because it's already, OpenAI has already got a deal going with Le Monde, El País, and the German publisher Axel Springer.
That's right. They've kind of added to their portfolio, if you like, of tie-ups here. But it also marks quite a stark contrast to other English language organizations such as the New York Times, which is currently suing OpenAI for claims violating copyright when sort of hoovering up information around the web in order to train its models. So it seems like a bit of a divide and conquer approach here that's been taken by OpenAI, bring some news publishers on side, and indeed I think News International is also in advanced talks with OpenAI, whilst leaving others out in the cold and fighting it out in courts.
How much does it make ChatGPT more human if you have writing standards such as, you know, as high as the Financial Times?
Well, I think this deal is more about getting accurate information. And we know that hallucination, as it's called in AI products, is a problem where they spit out information which just isn't true. So I think the main value of this deal is the kind of granular, accurate information that the FT can provide. But it's clear that other platforms may provide other kinds of more human information. So Reddit is considered to be a really valuable source of human-level data because of the sort of conversational nature of the data on the platform. If a deal were to arise between Reddit and OpenAI, I think that would send those sorts of products in a new direction and bring them even more up to speed.
Tell us more generally about the use of AI-generated text. The fact that journalism and reporting has been so, for so long, an incredibly important part of, you know, the human way of communication. When you look at stuff now, to what degree do you think that this a lot of it is being AI generated?
I think it's clear that a lot is being AI generated. The worrying thing isn't maybe how much is, but how little we might be able to tell the difference going forward. So I think I think the average reader will have a general sense still today if something has or hasn't been written by AI when they read it. Now, really, that should be disclosed in many forms of in news and other kinds of information, but often I'm sure it isn't because it's so much cheaper to do. But I think that the worry, particularly as these companies get more and more of these licensing deals, is that gap of perception will shrink to the point where we just really can't tell anymore. And that really does, you know, suggest kind of a fundamental break, I think, with our levels of trust and understanding of the media and how much we're willing to believe anything we read. You know, we know that distrust in media is already on the rise. I don't think this will really help if people have a general suspicion that something they read has not been written by a fellow human.
Josh Coles, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You are The Globalist, written and read by human beings. Finally here, pop icon Madonna is ending her celebration tour with a historic free gig at Copacabana Beach in Rio this Saturday. Monocle Radio's senior correspondent and avid Madonna enthusiast, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, tells us the importance of this concert for Rio and why Brazilians love Madonna so much.
Madonna is now planning to close it out with a bang, announcing her last show in Rio de Janeiro will be free.
Madonna escolheu as areias de Copacabana para
Brazil, I'm coming soon.
Madonna mania has swept across Brazil as the pop star gears up for a historic free concert on Rio de Janeiro's iconic Copacabana Beach this Saturday that is expected to attract 1.5 million attendees. The concert, which is set to break attendance records, has caused a citywide mobilization not seen since Rio hosted the Olympics in 2016. Beyond all the excitement, however, the event will be an important test for Brazil's second largest city, which is determined to host more international events and is looking towards the G20 summit in November. Negotiations for the concert have been taking place since 2021. As part of the deal, Madonna was invited to be an ambassador for Brazil's biggest bank, Itaú, while the city council has also approved a decree to make her an honorary citizen. In a lavish TV commercial filmed at Paris Opéra Garnier, directed by Jonas Åkerlund, she declared, "Brazil, I'm coming." And she's bringing a lot with her. The concert is expected to bring a huge economic boom to the city, with hotel occupancy rates already hitting 100% in Copacabana, while Azul Airlines has increased the number of flights to the city. Millions more are expected to tune in to watch the concert live on the country's largest TV channel, Globo. Brazilian audiences can be rapturous. I've attended many Madonna concerts in my life, and nothing can beat the energy of the show I saw in São Paulo in 2008. Indeed, the country is Madonna's second biggest market based on music consumption. Think of the spectacle this weekend as over a million cariocas sing along to Like a Prayer on Copacabana Beach. Since 2016, Rio has taken significant steps towards successfully hosting large crowd events, mostly through increased security. During its most recent New Year's celebrations, there were no significant incidents reported. Let's hope the city brings the same energy for Madonna and her fellow world leaders later this year. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And if you want to know more about Brazil's obsession with Madonna, well, you should be better read today's edition of the Monocle Minute. Go to our website and find out more. That's all the time we have for today's programme. Thanks to all my guests and producers, Vincent McAvini, Carlotta Ribella and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin. Our studio manager was Steph Chungu, with editing assistance with Lily Austin. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening today.